My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Secrets and Spies presents Espresso Martini with Chris Carr and Matt Fulton.
Hello, buddy, and welcome to Espresso Martini. Matt, how are you?
Hey, Chris, I'm good. Busy. It's hive of activity here.
Yes.
Looking at the screen of myself here, I look like a ghost, which is how you can tell I'm busy.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, I'm recovering from a cold, so if I sound a bit bunged up, I apologize to people. Yeah, I just had this luckily a mild cold. Hopefully it won't get any worse than that, but welcome to autumn or fall, as you guys call it in the States and in Canada. Yeah. Yeah, the temperature's changing. And no wonder you're busy, because there's so much kind of going on both in the world and our lives and stuff. So it's, today's episode, if anything, is probably one of the more complicated episodes that we've dealt with in a while.
Oh, God, this one's packed.
Yeah.
And it could have been like three times as packed.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, each subject could be an episode in itself, and maybe in the future with a guest it might be. But
and there's like very important stuff that like, we're aware of, but we don't have time to get to it today.
No, indeed. There's a lot. I mean, even just this morning, I've just been adding things to the next Espresso Martini before we recorded this one, because there's some interesting stuff going on with Venezuela and the CIA at the moment, which we won't be talking about today, but we'll probably be talking about in a few weeks.
We got to make time for that at some point. Yeah, we got to.
So apologies for anybody who was expecting that today. We're not talking about that. But what we will be talking about is obviously the Israel-Hamas ceasefire that's ongoing. Well, it's still ongoing as we speak. And then we've got the China spy case collapse, which is a big scandal in the UK at the moment that's pissing everybody off from every single angle possible for very different reasons. Then we've got the Select Committee in the US on China have just released a report, which is very interesting and timely with the China spy case. And if we get time, the MI5 Director General Ken McCullum gave a threat update from MI5. So we may or may not get to that at the very end. So the first one is the ceasefire, which is, Matt, you had a piece about, well, a couple of pieces, one in Foreign Affairs, one in The Atlantic, about this, and both are very interesting. So I'll hand over to you.
Yeah, so this is a very much a fluid situation. So, you know, who knows how it'll look by the time this airs, but here's sort of how we got here. We have a stable, we have a shaky ceasefire in Gaza, and hostages exchanged, all the living hostages exchanged, which is very important and very good. But here I'll break it down for us. So, almost 2 weeks after a Trump-brokered ceasefire brought a halt to 2 years of war in Gaza, the deal is already showing signs of strain. The agreement, the product of an intense personality-driven effort led by the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, called for a phased IDF pullback, a hostage for prisoner exchange, and the creation of an international stabilization force to secure Gaza and oversee a technocratic, non-Hamas governing body. Ironically, the turning point came after Israel's unauthorized strike in Qatar last month, a failed attempt to kill Hamas leaders in Doha. The attack infuriated Trump, gave Washington leverage to rein in Netanyahu, and pushed Arab partners to unite behind a single deal. Netanyahu's apology to Qatar's prime minister during a White House call helped break the diplomatic deadlock, leading directly to the ceasefire that freed the remaining Israeli hostages. But no one close to the process believes this marked the end of the conflict. Mm. Hamas is badly degraded, but not gone, fractured into dozens of semi-autonomous cells with no coherent central command. The organization's surviving leaders are trying to reassert control, rebranding fighters as, quote, Gaza security forces, and positioning themselves to exploit reconstruction aid once it starts flowing. Their history suggests they'll adapt, recruiting from released prisoners, rebuilding networks with Iranian assistance, and using humanitarian channels to restore funding. Israeli officials, meanwhile, warned that without rapid progress on disarmament, Hamas could regenerate under a new generation of leaders, much as it did after previous prisoner releases. For Trump's team, the challenge now is keeping the ceasefire intact as the ground shifts beneath it. American officials are increasingly worried that Netanyahu could dismantle the agreement, and Vice President J.D. Vance has been dispatched to Israel alongside Kushner and Witkoff to steady the process. Washington is also racing to define the plan's unfinished pieces, chief among them the stabilization force to be led by Egypt and the still vague timeline for Hamas's demilitarization. Tony Blair is involved in this also, mm-hmm. which sort of strikes me as peculiar. We can talk about that. I digress. Fighting has already flared in recent days after disputes over the remains of repatriated hostages, underscoring how precarious the truce remains. For now, Gaza's guns are mostly silent, but the road ahead is steep. The enclave is in ruins, its political landscape shattered, and any outside coalition that hopes to govern or rebuild it will face the same dilemma that has haunted every previous peace effort: how to fill the vacuum before Hamas and further suffering does. Chris, what do you think?
Well, like you were saying, I think that the peace plan is a very positive step forward. Obviously, it's not over yet. I'm very glad to see the remaining hostages free. That was very much long overdue. Some of the commentary has been rather one-sided towards Trump, overlooking some of the progress made by the previous Biden administration, which did manage to secure the release of 140 hostages, and that should not be forgotten. There's also been a sort of tendency to frame this as peace achieved in the early weeks it was announced, when peace has not been achieved in the Middle East just yet.
Oh God, it was insane, the hyperbole. Insane.
It was crazy. You know, it had very much mission accomplished vibes. I'm surprised Trump didn't just go to an aircraft carrier and stand and do a George Bush. But Trump's been doing other things with naval aircraft recently, which we won't go into. But it definitely wasn't mission accomplished there. You know, obviously this war has gone on for too long, and Israel's military actions have been widely condemned and disproportionate, even considered genocidal in the way that they've targeted civilians whilst pursuing Hamas operatives embedded within the population. That said, it is encouraging to see the Arab nations are working with Trump and the Trump administration to lay the groundwork for peace. Support for peace in the region is needed, and you know, having the Arab nations on the side of that is very important. This kind of current deal slightly reminded me of the case of, and I want to hope I get his name right, Gilad Shalit, the IDF soldier.
Gilad Shalit.
Yeah, Gilad Shalit, the IDF soldier who was captured by Hamas and later released in exchange for a large number of Palestinian prisoners. Some of those released went on to participate in the October 7th attacks. And it's a sort of stark reminder that any sustainable peace must guarantee both security and dignity for the Palestinians whilst also ensuring the security of Israel. Neglecting either side's needs will only set the stage, I fear, for another cycle of violence. And I think we've talked about that a little bit often in the past. You know, one thing I've noticed for years now, some members of the United Nations have been very dismissive of Israel's security concerns. And obviously with what's been going on with Israel's sort of actions in the last sort of 2 years, those security concerns have kind of taken a massive backseat for a lot of people. And I'm just worried that if that kind of continues, and obviously a lot of nations, members of the United Nations kind of like to reduce this sort of conflict between Israel and Palestine to David versus Goliath, and they sort of portray the Palestinians and even Hamas sometimes as the underdog, whilst overlooking or minimalizing acts of provocation and violence towards Israel. And tragically, I feel that complacency has helped lay the groundwork for October the 7th. And I really think that the UN needs to take a long, hard look internally at how they move forward with this as well, because they should not forget both, you know, security concerns of Israel and the concerns for the Palestinians. They both need to be heard. Otherwise, it will fall apart before it even starts. I don't see an easy path ahead for either Israelis or Palestinians. So much blood has been shed since October the 7th. You know, the assaults themselves are not only brutal, but deeply personal in some cases, often carried out by individuals known to their victims. You know, we talked a little bit about the kind of Hamas surveillance operation that went on before the attacks, and where they had recruited right. people like cleaners and things like that, and people who were kind of, you know, had access to go across the border. So that has definitely probably soured many relationships. And obviously some of the hostages were also known peace activists who spent years working for Palestinian rights. And then, you know, meanwhile in Gaza, countless families have been wiped out. Civilians have been killed in bombings and gunfire from Israeli forces. And I don't know how people on both sides begin to process that grief on both the personal and collective level. It's, to me, a bit beyond comprehension. It's going to probably take a few generations to really get past all that. And I don't really, and I think sometimes there are activists in the West who aren't directly connected to that region, but are going to run the risk of making that pain even worse if they're not careful. Like, there was a guy who was charged in Oxford, I think about a week ago, who was basically saying something on the lines of the Zionists should be killed or some nonsense like that. And his justification was because he was standing up for the Palestinians. That kind of language is not helpful. It doesn't help anybody. If anything, it's probably servicing his ego more than it is helping anybody on the ground. So that's, you know, that kind of stuff got to be careful about. Now, you've mentioned a brilliant piece in the Foreign Affairs that looked at sort of Hamas's leadership in the 90s sort of turned to Iran for help.
This is after the Oslo Accords.
Yeah, do you want to talk a bit about that? Because that's really interesting.
Sure, yeah. So this was in the early 90s, right after the Oslo Accords. This is an article by Matthew Levitt in Foreign Affairs. And Matthew Levitt is a longtime think tank guy, expert on the region, on various Iranian proxy groups like Hamas, Hezbollah. He's written a few books on Hezbollah that I have over my shoulder here somewhere. But in this article for Foreign Affairs, he talked about how Hamas was at this sort of crossroads after the Oslo Accords. You know, this sort of armed resistance side of the Palestinian movement was sort of not really in favor. You know, after the Oslo Accords, there was this sort of push to do so peacefully. They looked for sponsors elsewhere, and that's sort of when they kind of fell into Iran's orbit, which is to that point, you know, when Iran sort of became the patron in many ways for the armed wing of the Palestinian resistance. There's a great article there that people should go look at. There was a meeting actually that Hamas had right after the Oslo Accords. It was at a hotel near the Philly airport, which is probably about
that's really interesting.
10 minutes from where I'm about 10 minutes from where I'm sitting right now, which was kind of interesting. But I think going forward after this, I mean, first of all, to go back to sort of hyperbole that we saw right after this deal was sort of announced and in its final phases. I mean, it's a genuine win that the 20 living hostages that were left in Gaza have been released and have been exchanged. There are, I believe, as of this recording, I think remains of 14 hostages that are believed to be still in Gaza that negotiating through Hamas and everything, they're trying to repatriate those remains back to Israel. I know there are also Israeli troops searching in Gaza, like with bulldozers, trying to find those remains. So that's still unsolved. But just the hyperbole of taking what is, you know, a genuine win and a victory and a real good that the nightmare that these people have endured for 2 years now, these hostages, that is over and we got them out and that's resolved. That's a genuine win. But the hyperbole of trying to frame it as one, an end to this war in particular, which I think is too early to say that. It could be. Let's hope so. And it could be if it holds and progress is built on this. It's a very heavy lift. I think if I had to, you know, predict, I think it's a new phase. I think we're probably in the beginning of the end, I would guess, but I think there are clear incentives on either side, be that Bibi Netanyahu and the sort of faction of far-right ministers and his coalition that want to sort of keep this going and press annexations into the West Bank and everything for a number of reasons, right? They have their incentives to keep it going. The same point, Hamas, to the extent of the factions, their factions that are still armed and active in the Strip, they have incentives to keep it going to an extent. And there's also, you know, just the what comes after this, you know, getting some sort of a stabilization force in Gaza, some sort of a hopefully largely Arab-led security force without Hamas's presence, of course. Very important, very heavy lift. I think there's just a million things that could go wrong in the meantime.
Yeah, I mean, there's been reports over the last weekend, obviously, of Hamas crackdowns at the moment. I mean, you know, there's a big concern that Hamas are not going to go easily, and I don't think they will. If anything, that piece that you mentioned, you know, they might go to another hotel, not necessarily in Philadelphia, but somewhere else, and try and work out how they can come back from the ashes in some other way. One thing that I find really interesting about the kind of the 1990s period with regard to Hamas, it kind of a lot of kind of terrorist groups ended up coming to the peace table in the 90s, and it kind of coincided coincidentally with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I do wonder if there was some money that had just disappeared that may have forced some people at that time to the peace table.
One sponsor and the beginning of another.
Exactly.
Which, you know, during the Cold War, of course, the Palestinian resistance movement was largely secular sort of kind of leftist Soviet somewhat aligned. And it was in the 90s, of course, as you said, you know, when the Iranians came in and it became, essentially a Iranian power projection outfit. They hijacked that movement. I think if there's a few things that I would be watching for going forward. First would be the opening of the Rafah crossing, which is the border crossing between the southern Gaza Strip and into Egypt. The opening of that border crossing and the daily aid truck volumes. Right now it's still shut and I think is slated to remain shut indefinitely. If those numbers of aid trucks and what they carry coming into Gaza, that'll be a real litmus test, I think, for how serious the post-war construction phase is. And if we could sort of consider ourselves in a post-war phase. Second, I would look for is sort of a clear demarcation and an Israeli pullback to what they're calling like the yellow line, which is not a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. But this is sort of, it's a yellow line on a map that they, it's sort of pulling out of Gaza City proper and more to the outskirts of Gaza. If we see that, I think we'll see, you know, an entrenchment of Israeli positions some places in Gaza, if not a full withdrawal, but at least if they're pulling back to those lines and staying there, that's positive. Of course, all the remaining remains of hostages repatriated. That's something I'll be looking for going forward. And then that sort of like formal mandate and deployment of an an international stabilization force. And I think it's crucial that that Arab states are in the lead in that, and also trying to rebuild the Palestinian Authority, which is the sort of Palestinian government in the West Bank, which has been old and ineffective and corrupt, hopelessly corrupt for a long time.
Well, yeah. This is the interesting thing, isn't it? Because there's some old politics here with the tensions between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Because as you were saying, the Palestinian Authority has been deeply corrupt, and many people got fed up with it, which led to the election of Hamas in 2006, wasn't it?
The election of Hamas in Gaza. So there was that split. There was the election of Hamas in Gaza in 2006.
And then all elections ceased after that.
Yes, that was the last election. So up until now, Hamas has controlled, from that point on, Hamas has controlled Gaza. The Palestinian Authority, led by Fatah, which is Yasser Arafat's old party, they've controlled the West Bank.
Yeah. And I think the, like, with regards to the kind of Arab coalition, because I think it is vital, but I think also there needs to be a certain robustness to it, because there are going to be provocateurs who are going to try and disrupt this, as we already had with October the 7th, because that kind of totally disrupted the Abraham Accords that were kind of playing out at that time. And, you know, I've mentioned it already, Mr. Russia Hawk here, you know, has Russia's relationship with Hamas been factored into this peace plan? Because Russia's the great disruptor, as are Iran. And I'm sure those two are not going to be too happy with a peace plan that doesn't somehow fit into their interests as well. And I think that any Arab coalition needs to be very much aware of that and needs to be factoring that in for when inevitably some things are going to kick off somewhere. Somebody somewhere is going to try and provoke this to fall apart in some way. And that's the worry I have.
To that point, if you want to prevent that from happening, or at least lower the likelihood that it will happen, which I think is why that stabilization force has to be largely Arab driven and have that real kind of legitimacy behind it. So Tony Blair is involved in standing up that stabilization force, and the Trump administration has said that he would be involved in some sort of leadership role in there. I don't really know why. I mean, to me, I think Blair is some sort of foreign viceroy for Gaza, strikes me as like an incredible gift for Hamas in replenishing its ranks going forward, and presents a really attractive opportunity for any jihadist upstart in the region to, you know.
And anybody on the left who is skeptical about, you know, Israel and America and all that, his role in the Middle East, Tony Blair is the perfect propaganda example of why this plan should be treated with mistrust, because Tony Blair is obviously, he and George Bush were responsible for the Iraq invasion. And, you know, he's tainted. He's tainted goods. He's.
If you want an artificial, temporary, shall I say in quotes, occupying government in the Middle East to have legitimacy and faith from the people it's supposed to govern, I would not, no offense to Mr. Blair, I would not put him high on the list of people to have that job.
No. I mean, yeah, it's.
The other big factor here is the Israeli domestic political situation, which can throw a lot of sand in the gears here. So Netanyahu is simultaneously facing a domestic criminal case for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. He has an arrest warrant out from the International Criminal Court for Israel's conduct during the war in Gaza. So his domestic trial, Bibi's domestic trial, began in 2020 and is still far from reaching any sort of a conclusion. Since October 7th, it's been repeatedly delayed for security and diplomatic reasons. For example, a Jerusalem district court recently canceled scheduled testimonies because the prime minister's office cited urgent meetings, and I believe that was over airstrikes in Syria. The collection of far-right ministers in Bibi's cabinet that are sort of like, if they leave the coalition that he's in, it would pretty much throw Netanyahu out of government. So he sort of has to appease them to keep his job, and he has to sort of keep his job to stay out of prison. Interesting sort of wrinkle there right now. So with the case, with the case that Bibi's facing in Israel, so yesterday, Netanyahu's part of the Likud party. All the Likud ministers in Netanyahu's cabinet signed a letter calling for Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, to pardon him for those charges. I don't know what'll come of that. I'm not enough of a watcher of Israeli domestic politics to say. For what it's worth, though, Herzog is from the Labor Party and was leader of the opposition under Netanyahu from 2013 to 2018. So I don't know how likely that is. The other thing is, so a lot of those far right ministers that represent, you know, settler groups in the West Bank, like Itamar Ben-Gvir is one who comes to mind. So they've talked a lot about, after this war is resolved, going forward and annexing chunks of the West Bank. That's like something that they've said that they want to do, and they intend to do it. Interestingly, Trump is part of this ceasefire push in the last couple of weeks. A few times he's been pretty vocal that he doesn't want that. He doesn't support that. I guess he promised the Arab states, which have said to him as part of, you know, the Abraham Accords and their push to normalize relations with Israel, that, yeah, if the Israelis, you know, annex parts of the West Bank, like, we're done. Trump has said very forcefully that he's not in favor of that. With him, that could change at any time for any reason. Maybe it won't, maybe it will. It's impossible to predict with him. But I find that interesting that so far, right now anyway, Trump's laid that sort of very bright red line no annexation of the West Bank. I don't know if that'll hold, but I know there's a lot of people in the Israeli far right who are not happy about that right now.
Interestingly, about Trump, one observation I've noticed is that he is respected by Middle Eastern leaders, and he respects Middle Eastern leaders to some extent in return as well.
Yes.
You know, so maybe, I don't know. I mean, I don't know which relationship he'll hold more important, but yeah, he might well hold the line on that. I don't know. Who knows? Who knows? Could be like the tariffs.
Can I be cynical for a second?
Yeah, please.
There's a lot more money for him in the Gulf.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it's this is the thing. This is the other thing as well. This is where Israel has to be careful. I think we talked about this before as well. I've certainly banged on about this. Israel is very reliant on American and European support. I'm not the first person to say that. And I think what they have, their actions in the last 2 years has very much damaged that for the future. And so I hope for Israel's sake that they do improve relationships with their Arab neighbors, because if they don't, they could find in maybe 15, 20 years time that, you know, the future political leaders of America and Britain and Europe may not like Israel that much anymore.
They would be alone.
Yeah. And that very much is a real possibility. I think this war has done a lot of long-term damage that we will see down the line. And obviously there will be people who will attempt to exploit that for various reasons, whether it be Hamas, whether it be Iran, whether it be, I don't know, far leftists, far rightists, somebody, you know, people will exploit it for various reasons. And we've got to be, I think Israel needs to be very careful. Nobody needs to rest on their laurels about this. So Israel should be focusing on making a lot of friends, I think.
It's going to take generations to rebuild what happened over the last 2 years.
Yeah, especially, I mean, God, as I was saying earlier, like, how on earth do Palestinian relations move forward from this? Because there's been so much blood, so much mistrust, so much everything ramped up 100%. How do you get past that? It makes the, you know, sort of the Ireland-Britain relationship look kind of very tame in comparison.
Yeah.
You know, and even that's still problematic today, so.
Yeah, They managed to get past it, you know?
Yeah.
They live near each other but separate, and they kind of do their own thing, and they put the past in the past. I'm not saying that's necessarily possible for Israel and Palestine, but you know, there were certainly times in the 70s where that reality today seemed impossible, right?
Oh, yeah. Again, the 90s. I mean, that was a very interesting time and certainly opened up a lot of doors for peace and things. So, yeah. So, I don't know. I hope the peacemakers are doing everything they can to make that a reality. That's my biggest wish going forward. And I think we've got to be really careful over here with some of the commentary for people who maybe mean well, but are taking things into very stupid places. Like I said earlier about that guy in Oxford who kind of got into hate speech and started saying death to Zionists or something of that equivalent, which is unacceptable. That's not the language of peace. That is not helpful in any way, shape or form. You know, nor would the counter to that be either, where I've seen, you know, far right Israelis or, you know, people who support Israel who have said derogatory things about Palestinians as well. Neither of that is helpful.
Yeah. Sitting here today, I think this is probably the beginning of the end of the war that began on October 7th,
mm-hmm.
but it's not over yet.
No.
And when it is over, it definitely won't be the end of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
No. Well, isn't there a Nobel Prize for next year? So you never know. That might motivate things between now and then.
We'll see. There's always next year. Next year in Oslo, as they say.
Yeah. Because some of the ramped up commentary felt a bit like the kid handing in their homework a bit late to the nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize.
But yeah, it's just that. Yeah. What are you going to do?
Let's take a break and be right back with more.
Extra value meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
I Welcome back, everybody. So our next story is about this spy case that's been happening with regards to some two alleged British members, British assistants in Parliament, who have been alleged as being spies for China. It's been ongoing for some time. We've talked about this in the past, and we were awaiting this big spy trial, and then suddenly it just collapsed, and it has pissed a lot of people off. So it's very much the talk of the town at the moment. So I'm just going to pull from The Guardian. But Matt, you had something to say before I did that?
Yeah. I was going to say, the government over there is very skilled at just pissing everyone off. It's like a superpower.
It is. I know. The Labour government at the moment are so good at pissing everybody off. If you could somehow, they could. It's like the opposite of the Midas touch, which sometimes I feel I possess sometimes. But you can find a way to swing that around. It would be good. But anyway.
It's impressive. It is deeply impressive.
So, yeah. So I'm going to take some reporting from The Guardian here, and then it'll be, you know, interlaced with some bits from the BBC as well. But this is the main overview of this spy case. So the long-awaited UK spy trial against Christopher Cash, a former parliamentary aide, and Christopher Berry, his associate, accused of passing sensitive political information to China, was abruptly abandoned when the Crown Prosecution Service announced that the evidential standard was no longer met. Both men, who denied wrongdoing, were cleared after 2.5 years under investigation. Prosecutors had claimed that Berry wrote at least 34 reports for a person described as a Chinese intelligence agent, some containing information sourced from Christopher Cash, which was allegedly then passed to members of the Chinese Politburo. The CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, said that the material could have been prejudicial to the interests of the United Kingdom. Both defendants maintained that the shared information was open source political commentary and harmless. Cash, 30, was a Mandarin-speaking parliamentary researcher who had worked for various MPs, and two of them were Tom Tugendhat and Alicia Kearns on China policy. He was part of the China Research Group, which promoted tougher scrutiny of Beijing. Kearns said he was trusted and had no access to classified material, describing him as critical of the Chinese Communist Party despite his admiration for Chinese culture. So there is a bit of a distinction there. The case was expected to test the UK's strained relationship with China and raise questions about how espionage is defined under the 1911 Official Secrets Act, which required proof that China was an enemy. Observers like Luke de Pulford suggest that this could have been a politically awkward argument, particularly as the UK government under Labour seeks to stabilise relations with Beijing. The decision to drop the trial drew frustrations from MPs and ministers, including Security Minister Dan Jarvis, who called it extremely disappointing. Alicia Kearns, a key witness, expressed anger at the CPS that the CPS did not test the evidence before a jury, saying that something is very amiss. Downing Street insists the decision was independent of government influence. Both defendants have said their lives were devastated by the accusations. Berry's lawyer describes his client as just trying to pick up the pieces, while Cash said the ordeal has destroyed his life and the career he loved. The collapse of the case highlights the legal and political complexities of prosecuting alleged Chinese espionage in Britain's evolving national security landscape. So, Matt, what are your thoughts on this? And how is this also being portrayed in America at the moment? Because this is a big one here. Oh, is it not? No, wow.
No. That's why I was like, we should talk about it. Yeah. I don't take it personally. We got our own stuff. It just doesn't really break through here. Disclaimer, I'm not sitting here with a little powdered wig on and a black robe, right? No. Neither of us aside.
Yeah.
is the issue here in terms of how it was charged under the, is the issue here with the case, how it was charged under the Official Secrets Act, which the statute is written to say that the information that these gentlemen allegedly would have passed on would have to be, quote, useful to an enemy?
They've said this because there was an earlier case that set a precedent for spying cases. And I'm assuming it's one of the Russian spy trials that have been going on, because we've had three in the last year. And so what tends to happen, obviously, with legal cases, there's sometimes something will happen in a case before that changes the legal landscape after the fact. And so it kind of looks like the Crown Prosecution Service are kind of using a technicality and are basically saying that, you know, you would have to set that China's the enemy to say under national security grounds, the information they shared was, you know, of concern. So that seems to be what I've seen. I mean, you know, I could be wrong here, but that's what it looks like the Crown Prosecution Service are arguing. Now, they also, interestingly, did say there was sufficient evidence when charges were originally brought against the two men in April 2024, but because of the precedent set by another spying case earlier this year, meant China would need to be labelled as a threat to national security at the time of the alleged offences. So that's the kind of wording of it.
I think also, okay, so there's issues with the word useful and the word enemy, as far as the Official Secrets Act is written, right? So useful was alleged that they handed over like Westminster gossip, right?
Yeah.
So whether that's useful is pretty objective. And I think a defense attorney could poke a million holes in that. And then there's the issue of, did you give it over to an enemy? Which if the Crown Prosecution Service was to allege that and push that in the case, the government would have to stand up in court and say, China is an enemy.
Yeah, which politically, especially as China's a big economic power and important to trade, I think that's a bit
different
of a problem.
From a national security concern.
Yeah, and I think they should change that wording to foreign power, because obviously, if I think I was saying to you off air, if I were, let's say I was accused for spying for Italy or Germany or something, right? And I don't know, pass some information that might be useful to Italy or Germany. They're not our enemy, but they are a foreign country. And any information I share, let's say it was highly classified information, is illegal. But obviously they didn't share classified information. So this is probably where it's become more murky, because had they shared some like secret document that was top secret, then maybe the case might have been more clear cut. But they,
right,
from what we have seen and of what has been said in all the public commentary, is the Christopher Cash and Berry claim that the information they shared was information that was in the public domain. I have seen from some witness statements that are on the UK government website that some of the witness statements taken from Matthew Collins, who is a deputy national security advisor for intelligence, defence and security within the Cabinet Office, where in his first witness statement, it is claimed that there was some information shared that was only known to the two individuals hours before it became into the public domain and was already shared with their supposed handler, who's been named Alex. But obviously, again, a defense attorney might well be able to sort of counter that with something kind of more innocent. So it's, from our point of view, it's difficult to say either way, but that's what the witness statement says, and you've got it on, and it was read out in Parliament just the other day during Prime Minister's question time about why the Prime Minister being grilled about this case, because obviously at the moment there's a feeling of a cover-up of some sort for economic interests, and there's an accusation that the Labour government has somehow turned a screw somewhere at the Crown Prosecution Service and got this case quashed. And I have no idea if that's true or not. From the letter of the law, the Office of Government is different from the Prosecution Service, so that shouldn't be possible. Whether it did happen or not, I have no idea. I can't say, but it's supposed to be unlikely.
Here's a question. So some of the other cases, spy cases that have been tried in the UK recently, like let's say that Bulgarian spy ring.
All connected to Russia.
While ago. Do you know if those cases were charged under the Official Secrets Act? And if as part of those trials, the government had to allege that Russia was an enemy?
I don't know the answers to that, I'm afraid.
Which politically much easier than saying that than about China.
Yeah.
However, I'm just curious for the precedent there.
Yeah, considering the bit I read out earlier from the Crown Prosecution Service, I don't know of any other cases this year that have been, that have gone on, that could have led to setting the precedent for, you know, having to name the country an enemy. So I can only assume that one of these Russia spy cases, Russia has been named an enemy state in court. I can only assume that. Please, if anybody's listening who knows better than I do, and certainly we will be looking into the Bulgarian spy ring in a few weeks' time. But
it's one to ask about.
It is definitely one to ask about. It's very interesting. But obviously something has happened in court that has led to... because spy cases are notoriously difficult to prosecute. Because usually, like with the FBI, when they're investigating American ones, they usually like to catch the alleged person in the act of handing over a document, usually to a dead drop. So like with... Hansen, yeah, and various others. Okay. They've usually been caught, like, either picking up money from a dead drop and dropping off information. That's usually, because then it's very difficult for the defense to argue that they didn't do it. And with this case, I'm not aware of anything quite as solid as that being in play. So, you know, so unfortunately, these two men now have a big cloud hanging over them because they haven't had their day in court. They haven't been able to prove their innocence. And like, and also the government haven't been able to prove their guilt. And so there's this sort of just big cloud now left, which we can talk about very carefully, but we, you know, we've got to be, you know, there's only so much we can say about it because of, you know, libel laws, etc. So
if I'm in the Crown Prosecution Service, and again, not an attorney or a barrister or however you would call it over there at all, but if I'm in the Crown Prosecution Service and I'm looking at this, and okay, the information that they're alleged to give over is not, like, you know, super top secret code word, you know, like Trident computer system type stuff, like, you know, Five Eyes, I don't know, stuff at Men with Hill, like really sensitive stuff, right? Okay, that wasn't, stuff like that wasn't alleged to have been handed over, a serious national security risk. Okay, so there's that.
No,
the way the statute is written that they're charged under with the Official Secrets Act, useful to an enemy. Okay, it's not a slam dunk case that I have here. That's a concern. Prosecuting that case, that's not a serious national security threat here. That is not a guaranteed win. That would require the government to call China an enemy in open court. Is it a battle you want to fight? I'm not saying that they did the right thing. I don't really have a dog in this. I'm just trying to look at this objectively and all the pieces and, like, pick what do you want to do here.
I think if they had a slam dunk, this probably wouldn't have happened. I think somewhere in this pipeline, they have analyzed all the data and feel either the case is shaky or the information they shared was not really severe enough to be useful. Because to me, it looked like background commentary on MPs. From what I've seen, again, from these witness statements, the information shared is sort of commentary about certain MPs in certain positions of power within the Conservative government at that time. And obviously that information can be useful to China because then they can figure out how to potentially angle an argument in a way that that MP might you know, be receptive to, or they could also, if they know they're dealing with a China hawk, then they can kind of react accordingly as well. And I think that's the kind of information that looks like has been allegedly shared that is on this Crown Prosecution Service website that we are being able to look at the moment.
But so there's also the 2023 National Security Act, which is new, of course, it being from 2023, that replaces the enemy test with a foreign power. So rather than saying that this country is an enemy, a foreign power, which is a lot more politically palatable. Like, for instance, there are quite a few people here who went to prison for spying for Israel.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So why I don't understand, like, the legal system well enough to understand why that definition wasn't the one they needed to use, why it had to be the earlier definition of being an enemy. I don't understand why that's happened. And... you know, obviously somebody somewhere who's better paid than I am has made this decision based on something. And it just seems a bit odd, doesn't it? But again, like, you know, as we're saying, the bigger geopolitical picture for Britain and British-Chinese relations, because we've also got this There's another thing going on at the moment as well that you may or may not know about. So China wants to build this embassy. It's going to be the largest embassy in Europe. And at the moment, the government's already delayed its decision again on this embassy, and they've postponed their decision till December. And the interesting thing, the placement of this embassy, not only is it next to the Tower of London, which is ironic in some ways, because obviously Chinese intelligence would be operating from this embassy, as would any intelligence service would operate from there, any embassy, you know what I mean? So it's not like China's an exception to the rule here. But also the embassy is very carefully positioned near very important fiber optic cables that carry communication to the City of London's financial institution. That's a bit hinky. That's a very unusual spot to want to put your embassy, because it's not near any other embassy. I mean, obviously, having a large embassy, there are only so many plots around in London. So they've bought the former Royal Mint site, which is where coins used to be made in East London. And it's a very peculiar spot for an embassy. And they've chosen that site in particular. So some critics have said that this fiber optic cable thing is a bit of an eyebrow raising thing there. On top of that, there are certain rooms that have been in the plans that have been given to the government have been kind of blanked out, which has led to questions about what are those rooms going to be used for. And obviously then the Chinese are saying, well, we don't have to tell you everything. And again, I think in American embassy plans or British embassy plans, I don't think we necessarily reveal everything either. So it's all a bit interesting. But but Beijing have said that there will be unspecified consequences if over further delays over this thing. So this whole
don't let them push you around.
Yeah,
like that.
I know, and I think this is the thing. The post Brexit Britain, Britain feels a bit more because we don't have the kind of as cozy relationships with Europe we used to. It means that Britain is now back out in the big bad world, you know, and maybe having to have ties to relations with other places to kind of fill the gaps where, you know, our relations to the EU once were. So it's a funny, messy old thing, really.
Yeah. When the Soviets built what is now the Russian embassy, I believe that was in the 80s when that went up, tail end of the Cold War, on Mount Alto in Northwest DC. It's on an elevated position in line of sight between Langley and Fort Meade. So spies do be spying.
Exactly.
And I think as far as like defining China as a quote unquote enemy, I mean, that definitely would have pissed off Beijing. But I can assure you they already consider the UK an enemy themselves. I think for them that debate is settled, and they're actively targeting you guys in far more dangerous vectors than whatever was alleged here.
Yeah, indeed. Well, this sort of syncs in nicely with what you've been looking at. So there's a select committee on China have issued a new report that kind of talks about Chinese Communist Party activity in the US. So maybe you could talk to us a bit about that, because that might well be, I'm sure there's some parallels. What's going on in America is probably happening here too. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. Or it will. No, for sure.
Yeah.
So this is a recent congressional investigation that's raised alarm bells about how China taps into American taxpayer-funded research to advance its own military modernization. Really, like, shocking kind of story that I think most, I mean, you could like walk up to someone on the sidewalk and say, hey, this is what's going on. Are you cool with this? And 9 out of 10 people would say no, hell no. So, this is from the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. It's a bipartisan group and a rare corner of Congress that still shows up to work and functions. They released a report recently titled Fox in the Hen House, the U.S. Department of Defense Research and Engineering's Failures to Protect Taxpayer-Funded Defense Research. And it paints a striking picture. So here's one example. Between June 2023 and June 2025, roughly 1,400 academic papers acknowledged DoD funding while also involving Chinese partners. That's including over 700 collaborations with institutions directly tied to China's defense research and industrial base. So these are Department of Defense funds that are being awarded to U.S. academic institutions that then partner with Chinese institutions, Chinese researchers, right? And Chinese institutions, the Chinese researchers get the benefit of that research and apply it towards military defense development aims. So this report says these partnerships span some of the most sensitive fields imaginable. That's hypersonics, quantum sensing, AI, semiconductors, ISR systems, cyber warfare, and next generation propulsion systems, all areas with clear military applications. In some cases, American researchers worked with entities already listed on federal restricted lists, despite their known ties to the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese military, or their intelligence services. There's numerous case studies in the report underlining this point, but here are two. So in one, U.S. participation in hypersonic research with a Chinese university known as one of the, quote, seven sons of national defense. These are seven universities that are entirely geared toward their defense industrial base. They allegedly helped accelerate the PLA's own weapon systems. And then another collaboration focused on nitrogen research is said to have contributed to advances in high-yield explosives and nuclear weapons developments. This is really technical stuff. And in both examples, Chinese government documents openly credited American partnerships with closing the technological gap with, quote, more advanced countries. So the report says these lapses stem from deep structural failings inside the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, which oversees a patchwork of inconsistent vetting, weak enforcement, and almost no award monitoring. It's sort of a gap in the org chart that no one's sort of responsible to enforce this stuff. There are like bodies like the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, Army Criminal Investigations, and the NCIS that enforce this stuff, but those are for classified programs. This is not classified research, so there's no one there to enforce it. And many of these research security offices, the report found, don't share data, can't access their own grant records, and still allow foreign students or authors from adversarial nations to work on sensitive DOD-funded projects without scrutiny. This also highlights another ethical problem, and that's American funding flowing to institutions implicated in China's mass surveillance apparatus and human rights abuses, including research on human genome sequencing and facial recognition and tracking technology, both of which are publicly tied to Beijing's domestic surveillance and social credit systems. The takeaway here, though, is that an open, trust-based research culture has allowed itself to become a backdoor for exploitation. China's system, by contrast, is top-down, political, and built to serve its military first, not scientific curiosity or an open exchange of ideas. So we're paying, U.S. taxpayers, American taxpayers, are paying to develop weapons and technology specifically meant to one day kill U.S. troops in the Pacific and here at home. That's one of the things I said, like if you went up to people on the sidewalk, 9 out of 10 people would say absolutely not, no. So to plug these gaps, the committee introduced the Safe Research Act, which would cut off federal STEM funding to anyone collaborating with entities controlled by Chinese defense-linked groups and force full disclosure of those relationships. So currently, that act is a proposed amendment to the NDAA. That's the National Defense Authorization Act, which is essentially like the annual must-pass gigantic defense budget bill. Before the shutdown, the House passed the NDAA with the Safe Research Act attached, and it's now waiting in the Senate. I don't expect it'll face many issues there. Like, again, the NDAA is one of those things that just has to pass every year. But I wanted to sort of make folks aware of this because I think it's important and hasn't gotten the attention it deserves. And I assume most of us wouldn't want our tax dollars funding the Chinese military, not to get too controversial here. But
No. It's a great, because it's industrial espionage, straight military espionage, and it's happened before. Obviously, Russia have stolen military secrets, etc. But China seemed to have, it seems like they've turned it into a fine art these days, because if you look at a lot of their advanced jet fighters, they have a lot of similarities to American ones. And we've seen this with other military equipment as well. Yeah. it's a big problem. One couple of questions. So with the what was the acronym again for the act? The NCPP, what was it again?
The NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the big bill that the Safe Research Act is attached to.
Yeah. So one interesting thing about the Trump administration, which might be a positive with this, is of the way they insist certain allied governments are supposed to act and behave to do trade with America. And I wonder if this act, one possibility could be that the Trump administration need to insist that allies come up with a similar act themselves, because Europe and Britain research could be vulnerable to this and probably is already vulnerable to this and could do with tightening up as well. Because culturally in the UK, at least particular with academic institutions, I worry that, I've seen before, like, some universities and individuals within them have been very dismissive of government warnings, particularly around extremist recruitment and ideology on campus back in the 2010s. And the government's prevent strategy faced heavy criticism from institutions. And I felt then that a lot of well-meaning people kind of would just, like, turn a blind eye to government recommendations and then allow, with regards to the extremists on campus thing, would then end up allowing extremists to talk on campus to students. And that was unacceptable. And, things have definitely got better, but they're still not perfect. And I feel like we do need to have something in the UK, if we haven't already, a measure similar to what your committee are proposing in the States. And maybe this is where the Trump administration might be able to say, look, guys, if you're going to continue to do defense training, et cetera, with America, you need to adhere by certain standards. And I see there's a potential there.
Yeah. I mean, I think Europe, especially the UK and Germany, need to strengthen their research and development protections as well, especially as the whole European defense sector ramps up under, these new pressures from Russia and the ability to respond to that.
Yeah, it's a lot of espionage waiting to happen right there.
Yeah. China's going to jump in and do the exact same thing with you guys if they haven't already.
Yeah.
I think, as far as like, the sort of unrestricted open science advocates, and there is a lot of merit to that. I mean, it's true. Yeah, science knows no borders, right? It's just physics, it's biology, it's chemistry, it's just how it works, right? I think they would argue that co-authoring a paper with a Chinese researcher is inherently harmless, right? So their logic is, science knows no borders, and if the findings are published in a journal for anyone to read, what's the risk, right? Like, this information is going to get out regardless. Because again, these aren't classified programs that we're talking about. That would be a completely different issue. There's means to handle that, right? There isn't means right now to handle this. So I think the difference though here is it lies in what sort of never makes it into print. So it's that active collaboration that can expose Chinese defense-linked scientists to, like, the know-how, the data, and, like, the experimental methods that give shape to a project before it gets published. And it's that kind of access that can be far more valuable to China's military modernization than whatever's in a final paper. So here's an example from their report. So a 2025 Office of Naval Research funded study on swarm mission planning, right? So the mission plans for, like, drone swarms, the kind that we've seen Ukraine use in Russia to great effect against their strategic bombers. One of these studies is co-authored by the University of Texas at Austin, I believe it was, and one of China's Seven Sons of National Defense universities. That collaboration didn't just share results with potential military applications. It opened sort of a new window into, like, the research process itself. History is also full of examples of how open science can shape military innovation. So here's a story for you. In 1962, a Soviet physicist named Pyotr Ufimtsev is working at the Moscow Institute for Radio Engineering, published a dense mathematical paper called, ready for this, Method of Edge Waves in the Physical Theory of Diffraction. You can keep that one on your nightstand just in case. So it was a purely theoretical study on how radar waves scatter off an aircraft's surface, right? Sort of like the underpinnings of stealth.
Yeah.
Okay. It was a purely theoretical study on how radar waves scatter off an aircraft's surface. Not classified, just sort of fundamental research, right? Just this is just science and this is just how it is. So the Air Force translated that paper into English, and years later, a stealth engineer at Lockheed Skunk Works, Dennis Overholzer, stumbled across it. And Ufemstev's equations in that paper directly resulted in Overholzer's breakthrough that led to Skunk Works Have Blue, which was the very much classified technology demonstrator for the F-117. So the world's first stealth fighter was born in a Soviet scientific journal. Now, picture a different version of that story. And instead of just reading Ufemstev's paper by chance, imagine if the Soviets had actually funded Overholzer's partnership with that Moscow Institute on radar signature reduction. So how much sooner and how much easier would it have been for Lockheed to get the F-117 into the air? And I think that's the dynamic this report is warning about. It's not about, you know, banning science or shutting down research. It's about recognizing that sort of direct collaboration on even fundamental research work can hand an adversary the sort of practical know-how that they'd otherwise spend years trying to discover on their own or reverse engineer. And this is a lot of stuff that, you know, China's very open about this stuff, what they're planning to do and how they plan to do it, especially in Mandarin. So they'll, in a lot of the text and stuff around these programs, these projects and stuff that they're involved in, anything that's in English will totally sanitize any kind of defense-linked military application to this scientific research, this work at all. If you look at the same stuff about it, that's in Mandarin, that's all pointing inward, right? They're very clear about what it's being used for and what the intent is. But unless you speak Mandarin, you don't get that.
Which a lot of people don't. A lot of people don't. I don't.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I do menu Mandarin maybe, but that's about it. So yeah. Well, thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to add, or are you happy with all that?
No, it's a really, maybe interesting isn't the right word. It's an interesting problem, though, I'll say, for lack of a better word, that pops into my head. Mm. It's, again, not something that you would think happens or could happen. And again, it's nothing. It's not being done, at least on the U.S. side, in terms of these researchers and scientists and in these academic institutions. It's not something that's being done out of a place of being malicious or something or unpatriotic, right? Like, these people aren't like Robert Hansen or Aldrich Ames or something like that. That's not what's being alleged at all. I think it's just a lack of imagination about what the threat is and the extent of the threat and how big our own attack surfaces are, right? And it's a problem that has been identified, but there is yet no one who's clearly defined that, like, okay, this is your problem. You gotta handle it, right? So like the people at the Pentagon who oversee this funding and stuff, they don't necessarily have the remit or the personnel or the authorization to sort of like really crack down and enforce it. They should. But it's not in the letter of the law saying that they have to, if it was a classified program. But that's what this Safe Research Act would correct.
Yeah. Well, there'll be links to this in the show notes, won't there? So people can have a proper read of this and, you know, digest it. And feel free, if anybody wants to ping in questions or whatever, we can always, down the line, do our best to answer any questions you may have.
And this is a bipartisan thing. I mean, this is a bipartisan committee. I do not think that, I mean, how I feel about things and the current times is very well known. Nevertheless, here I am saying these things. This does not have to be a partisan thing. And this is, like I said, a corner of Congress that works. So let's embrace that.
Yeah. Well, that should be applauded. Yeah, should be applauded. You know, this is it. When it comes to things like national security and stuff, one hopes it isn't partisan. And, this committee is a good example of people from both sides of the aisle working together. So it should be celebrated. So yeah, important work they're doing. So thank you very much for all that, Matt. And well, that's today. I don't think we're going to get to MI5 today, but it's been a very jam-packed episode today. A lot of interesting stuff about China to think about. And we've got definitely some interviews lined up in the near future that will be looking at different aspects with regards to America, China, and China and the West over the months ahead. So, you know, stay tuned. Yeah,
a lot about China we got coming up.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot to discuss there, so that'll keep the Chinese trolls employed, I guess. Certainly on YouTube it will.
Give the Russians one a break.
Oh yeah, the poor Russian trolls. Oh well, I'm sure we'll find some content for them too, but there we go. Cool. Well, Matt, thank you very much for your time. Any exciting happening over the next few days for you?
I've been working my ass off on the novels. That's the hive of activity. Good. That's been going on here. I've been cooking.
Nice.
And it's one of those situations where, like, either the two halves of my brain are never really in agreement on terms of like, okay, let's cook now. It's more just like one side is like, okay, we're going to do this now. And then the other half has to, you know, get on board and not miss the moment. So that's sort of what I'm in.
Yeah, the artist dilemma, isn't it? It's full of conflicting ideas and things about stuff. So it's always quite hard to navigate that. The actual simple act of writing is probably the hardest thing. Sitting down and getting it out there. And then being happy with it as well. It's the other problem.
Well, that's a big problem. And then doing five of them at once. I'm not actively writing five at once, but I'm planning five at once. It's all sort of the same stew, and that gets very large attack surfaces. That's what this is.
Nice. Well, while you're doing that, I'm away next week doing testing my spy skills, I guess, to Spy Q. So that'll be fun. And I'm going to be shooting some video there. So I guess maybe in the next Espresso Martini, I'll be reporting back on that. I haven't figured out the format of how I'm going to report back on Spy Q just yet, but I'll figure that out and share it with you guys. I'll take some snaps and stuff when allowed. But I'll be taking some video there. Pretty a bit like the John Le Carre exhibition. I'll probably do a little highlights video and then we can quickly talk about it and stuff. So yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah, cool. Well, Matt, thanks again, and I will catch you on the next one. Take care. And thank you everybody for listening and watching. Take care, look after yourselves, and have a good weekend, and don't get a cold. See you later. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.